Well, hello and welcome into the second series of The Cultural Coven. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm your host, Nicola Roy, and I am just delighted to be back and with such a cracking lineup too. And what a showstopper of a first guest we have for you. It is none other than Tony Award-winning actor, singer, writer and activist. That's right, we've got a wee bit of Scottish Hollywood for you. It is, of course, the phenomenal Alan Cumming. I first crossed paths with Alan when I was 18 in Australia. I was doing a show in Sydney and he was over there too, and I vividly remember going up to him and dribbling something about loving the high life, and the poor guy had to endure this painful conversation, which he did with his usual wit and charm, and ever since then I've loved watching his career. He's just launched his new book, Baggage, Tales from a Fully Packed Life, which we do talk about in this episode. It's so colourful and honest, in which he chronicles his incredible career and how he overcame his personal difficulties. So I highly recommend that you beg, borrow or steal to get a copy of that. This week also sees the brilliant Lyceum Theatre in Edinburgh, whom we're in association with, reopen its doors and launch its season with a wonderful Joe Clifford's adaptation of Life is a Dream. It's a remarkable production directed by Wills Wilson, so do get tickets and go along if you can. Anyway, that's enough chat from me. I am so glad you're here. If you enjoy the conversation, please do remember to subscribe so you never miss an episode. And maybe leave a cheeky wee review too, if you fancy. Enjoy. The Cultural Coven is presented in association with the Stephen Dunn Theatre Fund and the Lyceum Theatre. Hi, Alan, and welcome into the Cultural Coven. I am just over the moon to have you here, albeit remotely. So where are you in the world just now, Alan?
I am in my house in New York City.
Oh, lovely. I just love New York. And here we are in the week of Halloween. Tell me, will you be going guising, Alan?
It's Halloween Sunday, isn't it?
Yes.
I'm flying over to Britain. I'm going to a birthday party in Yorkshire.
Oh, lovely.
So I'll be in a wee Airbnb. I think I'll just be having a mellow. Who knows? That's could be a huge lie, but I have no plans. And I'm normally big for Halloween, but this year just because of travelling.
I used to be absolutely minted when I went guising, Alan. We were given money rather than sweets round here.
Ooh.
I don't know if we were ahead of the curve or healthy eating, maybe.
Wow.
Well, nah, I doubt it. Did you used to do dooking, Alan?
Yeah, I used to do that. And what else did you do at Halloween? We did, like, here it's so funny, this trick or treat thing.
Yes.
That in America. And we never did that. We just went around in an outfit and just sort of presented ourselves. Maybe told a wee story or sang a song or something. It was a little more performative.
Yes.
Here it's basically, in America, it's like, you know, give us some sweets or we will do something bad to you.
Oh, really?
I think it's kind of like explains America in one little gesture there.
With a wee threat. That's nice.
Give us sugar or we will fuck you up. Yeah.
Hilarious. So, Alan, you are a Tony Award-winning actor, singer, writer, director and activist. You've packed so much into every day, it seems. But tell me, is there any better accolade than seeing yourself on the side of a kid's Happy Meal box or being the figure they get that week from Spy Kids?
It doesn't get much better than that. That's pretty exciting. I was also on Spy Kids. I was on like cornflakes and an orange juice. I've still got, actually, on my shelves upstate, me on the back of an orange juice packet. And I've kept the orange juice like 20 years old inside. I daren't ever open it. It might be a sort of nuclear explosion, but yeah, no, all that things, I really love all that. Like, I was a shampoo when I was in the Smurfs. Like, although I once went to the cinema and got popcorn and my face was on the bag of popcorn. Stuff like that is just never gets old.
Yeah, it must be quite surreal.
It's mental. Or like when you're in a cab and you pull up, you're in traffic and you look out and you're on the side of a bus. I find that just crazy and sort of hilarious and terrifying
and lovely, I imagine, sometimes, right?
I guess, but my immediate thing is, oh my God, I immediately try and sort of crouch down so nobody will see me. That's what I think. I think I sort of have done something wrong.
That's so funny. So, Alan, I'm just going to dive right in. So, as you know, my last name is Roy, so I get a few nicknames such as Nicola Rob Roy.
Yes,
fair
yes.
enough. And a play on Roy of the Rovers, so I get Roy of the Stage. But I think it's fair to say that nothing could ever eclipse coming. Yep. Were you aware of the potential wordplay and marketing dream of the surname Cumming from an early age, Alan?
I mean, yes. I suppose the early is the key thing here. I mean, once you get to sort of post-puberty, then obviously people at school and everything were much more liberal with their use of puns on my name. Yeah. So I've had that all my life, and I quite like it. It's actually quite good. I've kind of turned it around now. And actually, you know, I use it, like I say when I put things out on my social media, if I'm going to do a concert somewhere, I say, you know, like, people of Boston, I am coming. And I spell it with my name and not the actual C-O-M-I-N-G and stuff like that. So I've owned it.
You so have, Alan, and with real style. And actually, in your new book, Baggage, you talk about making deposits from the Bank of Hollywood to fund your passion projects, one
yes.
of which I know was your genius range of body products that contained a bar of soap named Cumming in a Bar, and your fragrance with the simple but punchy name Cumming. Tell me, Alan, what are the notes of that fragrance?
Well, I should point out that in case people rush to Amazon right now, you can't get it anymore. It's in the past, all this. But I actually have quite a lot of the soap in my basement right now.
All right.
Yeah, the notes of my thing were like earth, soil, peat, rubber, whiskey, leather, bergamot. So it's sort of earthy, smoky, you know, sort of a Scottish thing. They put peat and whiskey and things in it. For my Scottishness, and then the sweet thing is bergamot, but it was really fascinating to actually sit at a table with a proper nose person and sniff all these different things, and then make up a sort of a. Then he went and blended it into something. It is hilarious actually having your own fragrance.
I noticed one of the ingredients was Highland mud, and I thought that was quite interesting.
Yes, yes, that's right. I mean, the thing is about what is fascinating about fragrances. I discovered is that actually that all the great ones have like. Basically poop at their core, because you have to have a really sort of basic thing, a sort of dirty thing at the center of it to then put other things on top of it. So I mean, it's not actually poop, but you know, that's why we have mud.
Is it organic poop?
The organic sort of metaphorical poop, but yeah, it's sort of the essence of poop is at the center of all great smells.
Who knew? Now, I'm no marketing expert, Alan, but I do wonder if you might have missed a wee trick. What about a deodorant called Cumming All Day? Now, that would sell.
What about a mouthwash? I'm not even going to do the title. I think you can guess it.
No, I can guess. Now, that is good. That would sell, Alan. Well, as we're talking of ways with words, let's talk about your new book, Baggage, Tales from a Fully Packed Life, in which you continue to chronicle your career in Hollywood, your highs and your lows, and your transcendence from a fairly traumatic past. Thank you so much for letting me have a sneak preview.
You're welcome.
You have so much in there. It's heartbreakingly honest and it's humorous. And I felt like I was in an intimate conversation with you sometimes. I would describe it like a bag of dolly mixtures. It's full of colour and there's something in there for everyone. Do you get nervous when your book hits the shelf, Alan?
Yes. I mean, it comes out, as we speak, it comes out tomorrow. And it's an interesting thing. I mean, I'm less nervous now because I've had a few books, but also this is my second sort of memoir. So I think it's always more scary when you put something very personal out into the world. I've worked really hard on it. It's about my life. It's not quite as sort of revealing as my first memoir because I talked a lot about my childhood and all that stuff. This is more just adult stuff, but it's also, I'm talking about some things that, you know, are pretty personal and intimate, and also things where I look like a total hot mess. And then I realise that's what I think when you write a book, there's sort of three stages. You think, oh, I'm going to write this book for a reason. Then in the middle of it, you're like, oh, I see, this is why I'm writing this book. And then when it comes out, you're like, oh, that's why I wrote it. And so my the third part of that equation for me now, as the book's about to come out, is that I realize what I'm doing is, this book is me wanting to normalize being a hot mess. Everyone's a hot mess at times, and you can be successful and fabulous and do all your thing and happy, but also you're going to be a hot mess sometimes, and I think that's okay. I want to just make everyone not feel so bad about, you know, not being the perfect thing.
It's really refreshing to read, Alan, because we automatically compare ourselves to others. People will look at your life and think, oh, he's got the perfect life. So it's refreshing to be reminded that you are, of course, a human being who can also be a hot mess sometimes. It makes us all feel better. In your book, you also talk of your complex relationship with your father, something that I can identify with. But the line that really chimed with me is when you mentioned how that relationship informed your other relationships, and you finally realised that it wasn't that angry people were attracted to you, but that you were attracted to them. Yeah, and that was a bit of a light bulb moment for me. So thank you, Alan. Your book should come with a counselling charge for us all. Was there a catalyst for that realization?
Yes, there was a relationship that I just thought, what else can I do? How else can I make this person happy? And I was becoming so unhappy that I just thought, I've got to do something about this. And that's what I sort of, I walked away from that, and I realized, you know, I couldn't do anymore. And actually, I just thought, it, you know, it was one of these, it's not me, it's you kind of things. But yeah, there was one particular relationship that I really gave it more than my best shot, which I don't really talk about in the book, actually, that relationship.
Okay. I understand. Was there anything left unsaid between you and your father, Alan?
No, actually. I mean, well, yes, of course. But I mean, I actually felt the last time I spoke to him, you know, and I knew he was dying, I was able to say things that I felt strongly about how I felt he was cowardly and had, you know, and I was able to say, I know this is the last time I'll speak to you. So, yeah, it was a really intense, and, you know, that was, I was calling him up to tell him that the results of a DNA test that said that I was actually his biological son. So it was quite a loaded conversation. And he was like, well, I'm very surprised to hear that. And I was like, I bet you are. So yeah, no, but the things that are left unsaid or unresolved are things I don't think he would be able to help me with. Are things like, why did he, at what point did he decide that I wasn't his son? You know, what was the thing that's, I have my theories but when did he actually make that decision in his head and decide it was true? You know, that we all can kind of do that. We all sort of say, oh, that didn't happen, I'm going to pretend that didn't happen. You know, we do that in small ways all the time. He did that with my entire life. So I just, that to me is still something that I will never be satisfied. And I made peace with that.
Yeah, I imagine it's hard to understand the thought process behind that.
You can't expect rationality from someone who is irrational, and you know, I think mentally ill, so you just have to leave it in the road, as they say.
Relate, you sure do. An interesting point was put to me recently around mental health. I was chatting to my friend about how when I lost my mum, I was sad, and I spoke to my doctor, and they said, look, we're not worried about you. This is due to a trauma, not a chemical imbalance. And so there was no tablets or follow-up, really. And my friend said, but wait a minute, it's chicken and egg, isn't it? How do they know without testing that you didn't have a chemical imbalance and a predisposition to that loss affecting you more deeply? And I hadn't considered that before. And this is probably an impossible question to answer, but do you think, even without those horrible traumas happening to you, you know, we work in a business that seems to have a higher level of mental health issues than some. Do you think you may still have suffered from some mental health problems?
I mean, yes, possibly. I have to say, I think, you know, one of the things about this book, I want to say that everyone's got baggage. You know, everyone's got trauma and shit from their lives. And so maybe it's not as extreme as the stuff I'm talking about, but we all have stuff that we deal with and we're working through. So and I think the important thing is to not pretend you don't have it, and to deny it. And so had I had these things not happened to me, who knows? But I sort of feel like, I think, you know, I get there's some, you know, some people would have a chemical imbalance or chemical disposition almost to mental illness or mental ill health, even if they had the happiest and most untraumatic upbringing. I get that. But also, so what? It's the end result is the same, you know. And I think the thing is that what's been the one of the positive things about this pandemic has been that we've all talked about mental health much more, and we're all more concerned about checking in with people's mental health. That's been, I think that's a really positive thing, because something that's been lacking in our culture. So, I mean, I think like it's just really important to, you know, like I'm saying, I want to normalize being a hot mess. I think that's important for more people to just say, yeah, we all struggle with things, and let's not worry about where it came from. It's here and it's happening, and let's try and make it better.
Oh, I absolutely agree. And any discussion that raises awareness around mental health is brilliant. There are so many fantastic tales in your book, Helen, but one of my absolute favourites was a revelation that when you worked as a young journalist after school for the DC Thompson Publication House in Dundee, and you were fast becoming good at it, you were promoted to the horoscopes with no formal crystal ball training. Dundee's answer to Mystic Meg. I laughed, but I also gasped in horror at the same
terrible.
Time.
Yeah.
Well, I have definitely, in some indecisive times, made a few life decisions based on the horoscopes and the local rag, because why not, right?
Right.
Were you able to tell anyone that you were doing that, or was that a big secret?
I mean, I told everyone I knew, but I'm terrible at keeping secrets. I mean, they didn't have my name on it or anything. It was all very, you know, it's just like in a column in the newspaper every night, and it's dreadful when you think about it. But that's, I'm sure, many of the publications that we read also did that. I mean, I was 16 years old when I first started, and it's funny you say I was promoted. I don't know if that was a promotion to doing the astrology thing, but my honest goes.
Was it a sidestep?
Yeah, maybe it was just what you had to, because this is what's hilarious. Where I did that at DC Thompson's, I was in the fiction department. That was, so I wrote the horoscopes from the fiction department. So that should give you an idea. But I just used to, I would look at old other magazines, like, you know, Vogue and whatever, and these other things that were lying around that they had. And I would look at the horoscopes and I would get the sort of technical stuff. And then I would just say something nice at the end. Because I always imagined that my sort of, the reader might be a wee old lady with cats. So I didn't want to say sort of things like, you know, love is coming into your life. I'd make it all very like, you know, don't clean out your closets right now, or, you know, buy a new blouse, things like that. Just sort of leave it quite generic and catty, cat lady.
Oh, I absolutely love it. And you've also got all these wonderful pictures in your book, Helen. You have got style. You are a very sharp dresser.
Well, thank you.
You really are something I can only aspire to. I know you've worn many a kilt before, and I imagine you might own a few.
Yes.
But who is your favourite kilt designer?
Oh, well, it's Howie at 21st Century Kilts. I love him. He's such a hoot as well. And I've over the years, I've got so many from him and worn them in shoots and stuff as well. But yeah, I just love the idea of, I mean, that's what I think is kind of what's so exciting about Scotland now, is that it's kind of, it's got its tradition as this sort of core, but it's kind of modern around that and embracing modernity, and it's very exciting.
Yes.
But we're very entrenched as well in our tradition. And that's what I think Howie does. He kind of, you know, makes these kilts in different fabrics that you wouldn't really associate, in different colours. So I love them. I actually got married in a Howie kilt suit. And then it blooming well got stolen.
No.
Yeah, when I moved back, I was in London doing a play, and we were there for like about 6 months, and we got married whilst we were there. And then on all the stuff, we shipped it all back, and it all got pilfered.
That's awful.
And both Grant and I's outfits for our wedding got stolen. So when I look at the pictures now, it's like, it's almost like a magical, you know, moment, because I've got no connection to it from the stuff. I find that quite a lot, actually, when I look at pictures of myself, especially if I've, like, you know, borrowed clothes to wear for things, and I'll wear them and then I'll give them back. And so you see pictures of yourself years later, you have no idea where you are, you have no idea, because you don't recognise the clothes. It's such a bizarre thing that you think, what was going on there? Who was I? Where was I? Hot mess.
I just like that he makes kilts look like an everyday alternative to trousers.
Yeah, totally. And those ones have got a little thing for your phone and your what, you know, they've got little sort of flaps to put your phone in and everything. I really like that. I mean, I have these phases when I wear kilts more often. And but I haven't worn one for a while, actually.
Well, if I find that person that's knocking about in your suit, I'll hunt them down, Alan. So yeah. Textiles is just another example of what Scotland has to offer alongside whiskey, art, tourism, renewable energy. We could go on. And Scotland is obviously in a time of questioning her identity in the world and her future. And I know you've been very vocal in your support of independence, Alan. Mm. When did your desire for independence begin?
I mean, I remember in 97, it was when it was the vote for devolution. Because there was a thing, it was called Yes, Yeah. There was two things, there was two yeses. I can't remember what the questions were, but that was the I remember sort of then, that was the first time it was with Dewar. I went and campaigned with him, and it was actually a really great time because it was sort of the start of this change in Scotland, actually. I think since devolution, it's really changed Scotland's outlook. And although it's not, obviously, we don't have full powers, we get to decide a lot more about for things that are important to us than we did before. So I guess around about then, I don't know, actually, even before then, I remember the vote before when I was quite young. I think that was 79, was that 79? Something like that. You know, and I remember thinking, I was all for it then. I don't know. It's interesting, like when I was a little boy, I grew up in rural Angus, and the SNP then were kind of sort of a bit more of a more right-wingy. I was kind of had mixed feelings because I associated sort of, you know, independence, which I liked, but there's a more conservative thing to it. And that's really altered, I guess, because it's not just a one party. It's not a one issue party like I think it used to be a long time ago. I write about this in my book a bit, actually, about how, you know, growing up, it was sort of slowly realizing that, oh, I see, my Scottishness is sort of... is sort of not good enough in some quarters. I've got to change myself in some way if I want to go, you know, be successful. That was something that was slowly kind of, I realized. And that I don't like that. And as I've grown older, it's been very important to me to challenge that and to kind of also, you know, retain my own literal voice as well as a sort of metaphorical one. But that's something that I think we all still probably grew up with, that, you know, we're kind of reminded some tacitly and not so tacitly that our Scottishness is a bit of a problem for still quite a lot of people.
Yeah, it's something I've spoken about quite a bit on this podcast, which is that I grew up with, I don't know if shame is too strong a word, but feeling a little bit embarrassed about my Scottishness. Yeah. And it wasn't coming from within, it was the outside world.
Absolutely.
And of course I'm not going to speak in an RP accent because I wasn't born in England, nor did I go to one of the privileged schools. But hopefully we're starting to find our own voice. And I've done quite a bit of work in Scotch recently. I did Liz Lockhead's Tartuffe. And I know you previously played Valère in it.
Yes, and you were Doreen, weren't you?
No, I was Elmire.
Elmire, I mean, sorry, yes. That's such a great part.
Yeah, it is such a great part, right? Well, Liz was raving about you in the original, which I know was at the Lyceum Theatre, which this podcast is in association with.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, you would be a brilliant Tartuffe now, right?
Yeah, I've come into Tartuffe's range. Isn't that funny? Yeah. I would like that very much. Andrew Dolmire did it when I did it the first time around. He was so good. It was just great, actually. It was such a great production. And I would really like to. I actually did get asked to play, not in Liz's version, but in another version to do Tartuffe somewhere. But yeah, maybe one day. Yeah, it was tremendous. I really loved it.
So they say life imitates art. Let's imagine an independent Scotland. What do you think the first play should be that to go on in an independent Scotland?
Ooh, gosh. Well, I think it should be something new. I think it should be something that's not written yet. I think that would be appropriate. Something that is written for the time. You know, it's interesting. I do this show, a cabaret show that with my friend Ari Shapiro, who's works for National Public Radio here. And it's called Och and Oi. I'm the Och, he's the Oi, because he's Jewish. And I've been doing it the last couple of weekends, so it's fresh in my mind. And we talk about when we first met, he was the the UK correspondent for NPR, and so he covered the Scottish independence vote the last time, and he said that the day after the referendum, you know, when the results came out, the day after, he went to the Scottish Poetry Library and asked the lady there, and it's this poem called The Day After by the then Edinburgh Poet Laureate called Christine De Luca. And it's just this beautiful thing about how, you know, there's all these other things, that there's all these dragons to fight, poverty, prejudice, but there's nothing broken that can't be fixed. And I just thought that was such a beautiful sentiment, like how to deal with disappointment, but also like being sensible about. And I think something like that, to be have something that's written about the moment, obviously, if it happens and we become independent, there's going to be some people who are very disappointed and angry. And we've got to think about how we move forward and all make Scotland and everyone a better place. So I think that would be a really good, maybe Liz Lockhead would like to write something.
I think that could be a very good shout, Alan. I just slightly despair as I can't believe people are still flogging this rhetoric that a Westminster government who aren't willing to subsidise free school meals for children in need are somehow, out of the goodness of their hearts, subsidising a whole country.
Well, you know, all that stuff, the last time round, was all debunked. This whole, like, Scotland, actually Scotland gives more per capita than it gets. And it's just this rhetoric. You just realise, I mean, we've seen it obviously hugely in America, just misinformation and fake news becomes truth for many people. And there's still that sort of Daily Mail mentality of these, you know, oiky Scots asking for too much. And all the stuff about the EU, obviously last time, has completely changed, game changer. I mean, how could it not be better? That's what I think. Even if you don't feel the things that I feel about self-determination and feel the looking at Scotland from outside and seeing what's happening and the way, even on a personal way, the way I feel we've been derided and abused by the Westminster government and thrown to the side. Even if you don't feel all those things, just like how much worse could it actually be to have the sensible people who've been doing a good job governing Scotland to the point that they can, continuing and taking it the whole hog.
Yeah, absolutely. And I kind of just hope that the disaster of Brexit and watching Boris through the pandemic might finally be enough for people to go, you know, enough, we've had enough of the lies. Let's vote for something different, for a change.
You know, leaders, it's not just about making decisions, it's actually leading people and sort of giving them guidance on how to behave and how to, and inspiring them. And I think that if you look at Nicola and Boris and just at the messages they put out and the kind of tone and the calm, you know, it's just, she's in a different league. And I can't imagine why anyone would think otherwise.
I couldn't agree more. Well, now that we've put the world to rights, Alan, for Prime Minister, I really enjoyed the section in your book where you talk about working with many animals in films to varied success, the most beautiful one being the bond that you formed with the chimpanzee Tonka. And then there's the not so successful relationship with a goldfish, but we won't mention
Spoiler
that.
Spoiler alert.
But I also have on good authority, Siobhan Redman, that you have also met Hello Kitty, the cat with the rather large head.
I have.
Was that a love story, Alan?
Well, it was sort of, because I met Hello. What happened was, so I was doing a play on Broadway years and years ago on 42nd Street, and next door to the theatre, literally next door, was a Hello Kitty store. And I always wanted to go in, because I just sort of, it was kind of early days of Hello Kitty and all that sort of Japanese weird, you know, this. I think it's really fascinating, that sort of cutesy, kind of emo-y, gothy combo. I find it really interesting. And anyway, so I wanted to go in, and actually I actually have in my possession two Hello Kitty toasters.
No.
Yeah, you put your toast in, and especially if it's a certain kind of toast, a lighter kind of bread, you put it in, and if you get it right, up it pops, and Hello Kitty's face is on your piece of bread.
Shut up.
I know, it's incredible. And sometimes I sacrifice the crispness of my toast just to get a better picture of Hello Kitty on it. Anyway, the store was next door to the theatre, but I couldn't ever go because it was always people outside. You know, when I was going into the theatre, I would you know, I didn't want to go through the crowds that are waiting to get in or you know, hanging around. And so I just couldn't go. And I was thinking, oh, maybe I could go between a matinee and an evening. But it was anyway, blah, blah. Anyway, what happened was my dresser, Kimberly, she went to the Hello Kitty store and told them that I would really wanted to go, but it was really difficult for me to get it. So Hello Kitty came to me, and she came, like, somebody dressed up as Hello Kitty from the store, came into the theatre, came up the stairs and into my dressing room. I've got pictures with her. And it was just so insane. And what was so funny, you know, she's not allowed to speak. That thing, like, you know, like Disney characters, when you meet them, they're not allowed to say anything. So I was asking her lots of questions, and she just had to either nod or shake her head. Hilarious. And my favourite part is when she went down the stairs, it was like it was quite a narrow corridor. You know, Hello Kitty's got a massive head compared to her body. As she was walking down the stairs, her head was banging against the side of the stairs. It was so funny.
Oh, poor Kitty. Yeah.
Poor Kitty, I know. Yeah. But I've got these hilarious pictures of me with Hello Kitty. And like, it was Dominic West and Jennifer Ely were in the play with me. There's the three of us with Hello Kitties. I must find them absolutely bonkers. But yes, I met Hello Kitty. I've also met, do you know who Esther the Wonder Pig is?
No, I don't.
She's this pig in Canada who's this great, she's like 650 pounds of pig. And like these people, these boys who, they thought she was like a wee pig, you know, a wee baby pig.
Oh, the micro pigs, yeah.
Yes, but they don't exist, micro pigs. They're basically, they're either pot-bellied pigs, which are kind of wee, or they're massive fucking pigs that are just, and she's a massive pig. And she, they'd had to sort of move out of their apartment, and they became vegan because of her. And then they now have this animal farm animal sanctuary outside of Toronto. And they, and Esther's sort of the kind of, you know, spokesperson for it. And she's, and so I was obsessed with her. I love pigs. And I followed her, and actually they asked me to write a foreword for her book. I followed her on Instagram. And then when I was doing a concert one time in Toronto, me and a couple of my band, we went down to the farm to meet Esther. And it was so, we'd stopped to get her cupcakes in a little bakery. And we were going, and my cellist, Eleanor, we were in the car about to go, and she was just putting makeup on. I was like, are you putting makeup on to visit a pig? And she goes, I know I am. I'm really nervous. I was like, I'm nervous too. So we went, yeah. Greta Thunberg went to visit Esther the Wonder Pig as well. She gets all sorts coming by.
Makeup to visit a pig. Now that is a woman after my own heart. The Cultural Coven is delighted to have musical support from singer-songwriter, musician, member of the Red Hot Chili Pipers, and very importantly, a fifer, Cameron Barnes. This song, Coming Home, and the rest of Cameron's music is available on all the main streaming platforms. So go on, download it and have a wee dance about your kitchen. Thanks, Cameron, for letting us use this tune. Alan, I can't talk to you and not talk about Bond. You were incredible playing the baddie, aptly named Boris, plotting to take over the world. Did you have to go through any special training for that? Because you're seen, you know, running along walls of fire and explosions.
No, that wasn't me. I just sort of stood there and stunt people did all that. The only thing I had to learn how to do a pen trick that I was sort of worried about not being able to achieve, and then my friend Jason, he taught me how to do it, because it was, I showed the script to my friend, you know, the pen at the end, I flick it on, flick it off and twiddle it around my thing, and I thought I can't do it. And then I said to my friend Dixie, I let her read the script and said, I could do something else, couldn't I? Because I can't master this. And she was like, you've got to. It's the whole integral plot of the film rests on you doing this. So I kind of buckled down and did it. But that was mostly what I had to do. And learn to speak in a vaguely Russian accent.
Well, it was great. You were very, very good.
Thank you.
Alan, in your book Baggage, you talk about doing some other challenging things, such as being on the set of X-Men and being up wires, but being left there waiting to start and then having to confront a somewhat negligent director. And we are, of course, speaking in the week after cinematographer Helena Hutchins was tragically killed on set when actor, yes, Alec Baldwin fired a prop gun which turned out to be loaded. Obviously, the events are incredibly sad and shocking. But were you shocked to hear that something like this had happened on a set? Or do you think we should be doing more to ensure everyone's safety?
Oh, definitely the latter. I mean, here in America right now, there's the IATSE, the union that's of crew members, have been deciding whether or not to go on strike because of exactly this, you know, too long hours, not enough, you know, which then makes people, you know, slightly reckless or negligent. And it's a terrible, terrible thing. But the timing of it is actually incredibly prescient because, you know, people were walking off. I've been reading about this film that people have been walking off it because they were saying that they had to do these 100-mile round trips to come to work. They're exhausted, and the conditions on the set were not. It's just, I think people don't realize how, you know, we joke about you work 15-hour days, and we are the actors, and we get to lie down in our trailers, and we're kind of looked after and pampered because we've got to like turn it on when we get on camera. But the crew, I've got to do those days and longer sometimes, and you know, it's not right. It's actually, I think things have to change in terms of, because things like safety and people's mental health again really get affected. So I mean, this is a horrible thing, and I really do feel bad for Alec Baldwin, because I mean, how do you recover from that, you know? And but yeah, it's actually quite timely in terms of we need to probably have a look at why we do such ridiculous hours. And, you know, I mean, in a way, hopefully this will make a big review happen of on-set practices.
Mm, yeah, we can only hope. As you know, there's quite a lot of filming taking place in Scotland, but finally we have three much-awaited new studios. There can't be many people that have done more films in New Ellen. What potential do you think these studios could hold for Scotland? What do you think the impact could be on our culture and film sector?
Well, you know, I think people are dying to come to Scotland. Like, film people are dying to come. It's got, you know, just they like it, and people like Scotland, you know. But so to make it easier for films to shoot there, I think is a no-brainer, and I think it's crazy we've left it so long. But it is really exciting because also Scotland's one of those places where you can be in so many different places in such a short distance. That's what film people need. Like, I've shot tons of things in Vancouver because there's mountains, there's sea, there's all the, you know, and there's everything. And there's great sound stages. So I think it's a really good investment. And I think, because what then happens is you need to have an infrastructure builds up. You have Scottish crew, but you have crew who come to work there and they stay and they do it. And then you have, you know, even if the tax things, a lot of these things are dependent on tax breaks that the government give. Even when the tax breaks go away or get less, people come because of the great crews. So it's a really important thing to kind of build up and train people, train young crew members and people new to the business, train them into, so there is a longevity and there's a structure there. So I think it's great. I mean, I think it's been a long time coming, but I think it's finally exciting.
Would you like to work more in Scotland?
I'd love to work more in Scotland. You know, I worked there quite a lot, but haven't made a film, certainly not, you know, a film in a studio for ages.
Yeah, it'd be really exciting for you to be filming here. Is there a role that would bring you back onto a Scottish stage?
Yes, but I don't know what it is. There's lots of things. There's lots of things in the offing. I mean, I don't actually have, I always think that thing of, you know, when I was younger and people say, oh, what's the role that you really want to play? And I would always say King Lear, because I was, it was ridiculous. It was like, you know, now it's not that far off. So I've got to stop saying it because I don't want to play King Lear and I don't like it. So I'm not gonna, but there's other things that I, you know, there's always a few irons in the fire. I'm coming back next year to do a thing, with them at the Edinburgh Festival and stuff, and on a tour, and then coming to America. I'm playing, well, it's a solo dance piece. I'm doing a dance, I'm making my dance debut, age 75,000. It's something to do with Robert Burns, don't quite know yet. And I'm working on it with Stephen Hoggett in the National Theatre of Scotland and stuff. So, but yes, I am coming back to the Scottish stage next year, but I won't be speaking much. I'll be speaking with my body.
Well, I really look forward to that because I saw your nifty moves when I used to watch The High Life. I adored The High Life. I used to sing Piff Paff Poff in the playground. I was obsessed with really? It, with yourself and with our lovely mutual pal, Siobhan Redman.
Of course. And Forbes and Patrick.
Yeah, just brilliant. I heard a rumour that might be coming to the stage. Is this true?
Well, that's one of the things we've got, one of the irons in the fire. Yes, we've talked for a while about doing a musical of The High Life. And it practically is a musical already. I mean, there's actually, it was only 6 episodes of it, but there's like 4 or 5 songs already. And we thought it would be a fun thing to, yeah, we were kind of talking about it before the pandemic happened, and then we kind of got waylaid. But yeah, I think it's something on the cut. And I actually like the fact that, like, Forbes is a little worried that, you know, we're getting too old. And I said, I think it'll be hilarious if the fact that we're still flight attendants hitting 60 or whatever. I think it's hilarious, and us dancing it like that. I think we have a lot of flashbacks, so younger versions of us will come in and jump around. But we're also, Forbes and I are also doing a sort of talking about a Victor and Barry thing, because next year, 2022, will be the 40th, we discovered recently, the 40th anniversary since we made up Victor and Barry.
Wow.
Isn't that nuts?
It is. I watched a video of you two doing a sketch at the Edinburgh Festival last night, and you called it the Edinburgh Festival, or what was it?
An Oxford ghetto.
Yeah, an Oxford ghetto, yeah, and it cracked me up. I was like, that is so accurate.
Yeah, it's like a little piece of, oh, Edinburgh, a little piece of Scotland that for 3 weeks of every year is forever England. That's what he used to say. And then, yeah, it's basically like an Oxbridge ghetto.
I love it. It reminds me of that thing that happens at the Edinburgh Festival. I'm doing Edinburgh.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
Edinburgh. I do Edinburgh 365 days a year, pal.
I know. I love it doing Edinburgh. It's so hilarious.
I know, right? Talking of, let's say, controversial things, in your book you confess that you've never tried heroin, but if you reach 80 you will. Mm. And you've hit the press over that this week. Now, not that I want to advocate taking drugs, but I do get the tongue-in-cheek tone of your book at times, and I could understand if at the age of 80 you had a burning passion to do something and you're not going to hurt anyone else.
Right.
Do you have a response to the press around that?
I just think, actually, you know, in the context of the book, it's always, I think, when you do something like this, there are various things, you know, and I always think, oh, slow news day. And then it kind of, it comes out, Alan Cumming wants to do heroin. I don't. But I talk about drug use in my book. And I mean, I was making a kind of a joke about things that you think, things that scare me, things I wouldn't do, and actually think, but I am very curious about, and I don't have an addictive personality, thankfully. So anyway, that I just think it's, you know, it's tomorrow's chip paper, but it's also just like sensational things that take something when you're trying to make a point and make it about something else. That's been happening to me for 40 years. So I kind of, you know, it's interesting if you Google when I'm doing something like this, like a press tour, and I start, oh, I wonder if that article's come out, and I Google, and then sometimes there'll be some, I think, oh, crikey, what's that? Some big headline about something ridiculous, like Alan Cumming wants to take heroin, or, you know, stuff about the X-Men. And then I sort of think, oh, and then, like, you know, the next day they've moved on to something else. So tomorrow's chip paper, that's what you have to remember.
Exactly. And, you know, you get it within the context of the book, you know. There's so much human in there. You get that you're just sort of...
But also I think it's usually things like if someone's mentioned it on a podcast or something, and these people haven't read the whole book, and they don't have to, but I just think it's, you know, it's,
I have
oh, bravo, I can tell. But, you know, the tabloids who just take a headline and make and run with it, it's you know, whatever. I don't you have to let it go.
Yeah, absolutely. As you may have heard, I am a complete and utter social butterfly, so your book and stories of parties and incredible people is just a feast for me, particularly your mentions of the incredible Liza Minnelli. And I believe you went to her wedding, to David Guest. I imagine that was just the most riotous and fun affair ever.
It was. It was completely nuts. Like, there was like a press line, first of all, to get into the wedding. There was like a red carpet. I was like, I'm not doing it. I was like, I'll take my photo. But it was like going to a premiere. It was a press line. Yeah. And then we had to wait for ages. Well, first of all, when she came down the aisle, it was The Greatest Love of All was being played, but it was actually Whitney Houston was there actually singing it. And then, you know, like Michael Jackson was the best man and things, or and Elizabeth Taylor was the matron of honour or something. But what we had to wait for ages, because Elizabeth Taylor came out in her slippers or something, and she had to go back and get her shoes. It was something ridiculous like that. Everything about it was hilarious. And then there was a big the party afterwards was just all these incredible people. Because the venue they had it in is called Cipriani's downtown, and they have a lot for charity things and galas. I go there quite often, and I always remember there's a sort of a raised bit, a sort of a raised level where they sometimes have like little drinks beforehand or an after party, and that was where at Liza's wedding. The band was downstairs, and we're all, all these incredible musicians were playing. Then all of a sudden, the guitarist from Queen, Brian May, appeared on the top of the thing, sort of standing there. We all looked up, and he did the guitar solo of We Are the Champions. It was just insane. Wow. It was insane, yeah. And it was all the most crazy people in the world were there. It was absolutely nuts.
The stuff of dreams, Alan.
Yes, I suppose so, yeah. Although I never dreamt about it's a nice wedding, but it was such a and then of course it was such a bonkers and the funniest thing was I've never been to a wedding where where when they kiss that the bride pushed the groom away because he was getting a little too into it. We could practically see tongue, and Liza was going like, David, don't, the whole thing was hilarious and lovely. It was a lovely day, but it was all, in retrospect, it was kind of a disaster waiting to happen.
Well, hopefully this prediction won't be disastrous. What am I talking about, Alan? I am talking about your creative challenge. So, as I mentioned, it cracks me up as a teenager that you wrote the horoscopes for DC Thompson's publications. And as Scottish arts and culture begins to slowly reopen, your creative challenge is to do a horoscope for what lies ahead for the sector, Mystic Al. So please give us your predictions or any pitfalls that the industry should watch out for. I'll give you a couple of seconds to conjure the spirits.
Okay. So I think as Uranus descends and we all sit back into our lives before the pandemic in the arts and culture world, I see much happiness, much openness, much relaxation, but also I see storm clouds looming. I see storm clouds of people trying to take our gifts away, take our plenty away from us in the arts world. And I think ultimately though, if we all work very hard, we will have an art scene in Scotland that is full of plenty and full of independence and self-determination and ultimately great, great artistic merit. But we have to rid ourselves of the shackles of imperialism, and we have to make sure that our Mercury does not return in a way that diminishes us, but our Uranus descends and is happy, makes us happy all round.
Thank you very much. Every time you said Uranus, I thought I was gone.
I know.
That was wonderful.
Yeah, yes, it never gets old, Uranus.
It really does not. Thank you very much for that. And I'm sure everyone will observe that advice, Alan, over the next 12 months.
Uranus.
Moving on from you being defined as Mystic Meg or Mystic Al, you mention in your book how when you and your friend Monica Lewinsky were photographed for Vanity Fair in 1998, both of you were defined by your sexuality then. But you were celebrated and Monica was vilified. And you have been a great ally to women. It feels sometimes like nothing has changed. Do you think we're in danger of digressing into a more misogynistic world, Alan?
Yes, I do. I mean, I think that, it's all swings and roundabouts. You sort of think, well, at least with Me Too and stuff and all those sort of everyone's questioned behavioural patterns and work practices. And then, with Monica, I think it's really interesting about how she has had this return to society and become a cultural figure again in a really positive way, using what happened to her as a way to kind of make, change people's ideas about shaming and bullying and all that stuff. That's been great. But, she did have like 20 years or something, or 15 years where she couldn't get a job. She was, basically in the wilderness. And yet the man who was her boss, the powerful person in that scenario, completely was, rehabilitated and as seen as this great guy. And I think that tells you a lot about the patriarchy and the way we are. And I think just as great things are happening and we're much more aware of, you know, more women are in parliament and all that stuff, we've also got in America right now, you know, certain states have banned abortion, and it's going to come to the Supreme, the Roe versus Wade, the big thing that was the turning point in abortion becoming legal, that is actually in threat. So women are being given a voice and more positions of power, but at the same time their power of control over their own bodies has been taken away by, of course, a bunch of white guys. So it's I mean especially I'm talking, you know, someone who's living in America right now, I'm very aware that the situation that we had with Trump could easily come back and come back worse. And I, you know, at the end of the Trump era, I was I was really scared. I was getting death threats for posting things. It was a really terrible time. Everyone was very, it was very, very polarized. And I felt like, you know, why am I living in a country that I'm scared? I'm scared to be in just because of me voicing my political views. And so it's very, very polarized. And it's very, very scary. But, you know, luckily now the pendulum has swung a little bit and it feels like there's some decency and some leadership. But I don't know. I feel like I don't take anything for granted. I think being, if you come from a marginalized group in society, women, I include in that, queer people, definitely. I think you've got to be vigilant because, you know, look at history. We've always had to fight, and we've always had to fight to retain our rights. So
yeah, and you've been such a wonderful activist for so many causes, Alan. Do you do that due to lived experience, or have you been inspired by others, or were you just raised in a way to talk about these issues and to stand up for other people's rights?
Well, it's sort of both, but I think actually when, you know, I think it's interesting that I feel like having moved away from Scotland makes me much more aware and heightened, have a heightened understanding of what the things are about me that are Scottish and what I sort of learned from, you know, qualities I have that were about where I grew up and who I was around. And I think my activism, my speaking out about things is completely to do with the fact of being Scottish. Like I always say that my biggest sort of memory of what I heard growing up was, that's not fair. And if something wasn't fair, that was the bottom line. We have to change it. You know, that and the kind of political engagement that people have in Scotland is immense. And I think that's a great thing. But I do think, you know, there's like any society, there's lots of problems, there's poverty, there's all these things. But actually, I think the idea of a safety net is something that people think of as absolutely integral to our well-being. And looking after each other, looking out for people less fortunate than yourself is something that's ingrained into you. It's just a part of living. It's not something that is seen as that you are, you know, an extra thing you have to do. It's just what life is. So I think I do really feel that. And also, I'm just, you know, if I wasn't Alan Cumming, I would just be a person who would think the same things as I do and would have less of a platform. I've always felt like that. I've always felt like that was around me, this idea that we've got to be careful and got to look out for people, and if things aren't fair, you do something about it.
Yeah, and that's something I really took from your book. Almost like the saying, treat others is how you as you would like to be treated. And that is what you take from...
Yes,
it's really,
and just like kindness is all. Like, there's no, my mum always says that, you know, there's no situation that will go better without kindness. You know, kindness will make everything better. Even if you have to say something bad to someone, even, you know, if you have to fire someone, or you have to let someone down, or if you have to chuck someone, or you have to tell someone you've done something terrible, there's ways to just being kind about it will make everything better. Sometimes people behave how they think you're going to behave to you, how they think you're going to behave, and they think you're going to be the sort of drama queeny, you know, diva. And I think that's partly because maybe they wish they would like to do that, because they associate power with being able to behave badly to people. And I'm not like that. And it really pisses me off when I see people who are around me sometimes and who have some sort of power, sort of being mean to other people because they feel being in my orbit means they can. Really pisses me off. And I just think that no, there's no reason for that. Everything will go better by just being kind and courteous and nice.
Oh my goodness, yes, yes. There has been a long trend of bullying and such like in our business, and things like that just can't continue anymore.
No.
No one is good enough that they should be allowed to bully others in a company.
Oh, I hate that sort of like, oh, but they're so talented, even though they're, you know, totally shitty to people. Nobody's that talented. And also, even if they were the most, you know, even if they're Meryl Streep or whatever, or, you know, you or Siobhan Redmond, you don't get to, that should not be equated with how you comport yourself in life, you know. That's not a correlation that you can make. It doesn't, it's like saying, when people say, oh, something about the Bible to me as some argument in a thing, I'll say, that doesn't work because I don't believe, I'm not religious. So you can't use, that'd be like me using my book as sort of, you know, as evidence or something. It just doesn't make sense. You can't correlate in that way. And I think the whole, and especially men get away with it much more. If a man's really, you know, shitty on a set or at work, they'll say, oh, he's so demanding and so such a perfectionist. And if a woman does it, she's a bitch. And, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Or if you speak up, you're a troublemaker, seen as difficult. Yeah. Or if you challenge, yeah, you're perceived as difficult.
Absolutely.
And that's why I have been guilty of not speaking up when I've maybe experienced unkind things, even though my inner voice is telling me to, because you just want to work and you want to get on with everybody. But that's also not right either.
I mean, that was kind of what, you know, I remember, you know, the equity debt, the whole thing of having, whenever you do a job in the theatre, there's a person who's sort of the connection to your union. And that, I think, that's, if we could have that structure a bit better. And it's always a bit like, oh God, who's going to be the equity debt? But, you know, so I remember it being like, oh, rats. But actually, as a person who is a representative, so there's a sort of a channel to take people's grievances and actually have them dealt with properly. I think we've got to go back to that a bit more and make sure that people feel safe and secure enough to come forward if they've got anything, like you're saying, if they, you know, and not worry about their potential future employment.
And hopefully that's something, maybe as we emerge from the pandemic, I think there's a chance for change, and we should look at changing things.
I hope so. I sort of feel like the pandemic, I'm a very optimistic sort of person, and I try and find the good in everything. But I do feel that this time of having so much sort of self-reflection and time away from our normal lives and all the sort of way we function normally, and seeing how we dealt without having those normal things around us, and sort of thinking, well, maybe what do we really want in our lives, and what do we think is important? I think, and also for the first time ever, we've all had to think about how our behaviour affects other people. And I think that hopefully will make us a more compassionate race when we go back to it. Because, you know, everyone, this is the first time when everyone in the world has been going through the same thing in various degrees. So, I mean, it's a little Pollyannish, but I really hope that when we go back, I mean, I have to say that I did a thing a couple of weeks ago. It was Fashion Week in New York, and I was hosting these fashion awards for my friend Eddie's magazine. And you know, those things can be a little, it's kind of fun, but they can be a little sort of, fashion is not the most compassionate industry in the world. But it was actually really lovely. People were so kind, and they talked, when they gave the awards to other people, they talked about them in a way that they wouldn't ever have done before. It's much more personal, much more compassionate and kind. And so I thought, oh, that bodes well. We'll see how long it lasts. And also everyone's like, you know, they've had a year of not having to shave their legs or, you know, worry about their waistlines. So I think that probably did them a lot of good.
Oh my goodness, yeah, that's why I'm going as a pumpkin at Halloween.
You look gorgeous. I'm enjoying your shoulder thing, and your hair looks nice.
Oh, thank you, Alan. I'm definitely keeping that in. we're very easily categorised in this industry. You know, they love to pigeonhole us as a type. But you always seem to be ahead of the curve. You're always changing yourself, Alan. Are you consciously trying to prove or challenge people's perceptions of you as an actor?
I mean, I suppose so, yes, because I think actually acting is, you know, I think when I wanted to be an actor, it was because of I could play lots of different things. That, to me, was exciting. And I think maybe probably in my time of being an actor, it's the notion of like sort of movie star. Like in America, people just want you to kind of be the same. Do you know? Most American actors kind of play similar things. It's not acting like we know it in terms of, you play a very different person each time. And I know that happens, but I think that's happened more in, even in our culture too. But I mean, I guess I, you know, early on when I did work with Forbes, I sort of was kind of conscious that we both were, that, you know, we were perceived as funny people, even though, so I guess maybe I did some, I thought about that then, about, oh, maybe I should, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I guess at the same time I was playing things like Hamlet and everything, so it was, you know, not all that's quite cheesy in sports. But yeah, I've always been, I think early on I was more conscious of it. Now I just feel it's my life. I just sort of mix and match things. And I mean, it's interesting just also as growing older, you go into different categories of roles and you know when you get a script and you get the description of a role that you look for first, and there's this, I'm about to do this film, I'm coming to Scotland, Britain this week, and then I'm doing my book, and then I'm coming back to start this film with Katie Holmes, and in the character description it says, you know, early 60s, thinning hair, kind. And I was like, well, I can do kind. And I went for my costume fitting last week, and I'm supposed to be this sort of, you know, sort of man who runs an antique shop, older man who runs an antique shop, nice man, but I went for the fitting, and for the first time I heard myself saying, oh no, I think, no, my ass looks too good in this suit, this is not right. I was actually thinking, wow, words you never thought you'd say, but yeah, had to sort of change the whole look of the costume fitting, because I thought I'd, you know.
I love it. Well, you look far too good to be playing a 60-year-old, though, Ellen. They're going to have to do some massive aging up on you. Not character description, but the most hilarious review description I ever had was an ugly Betty lookalike that chatters like she's on speed.
What?
No, well, to be fair, I did have big glasses and a wig, and it was a comic role, but the description just cracked me up.
Well, that's awful. My worst one ever is when I was doing that play, that when Hello Kitty came, it was called Design for a Living by Noel Coward, and it said, so it was Jennifer Ely and Dominic West, and it said stuff, it kind of said some horrible things about me. They didn't think I was very good, and then they said that they were quite good, but it said, but even so, they are cast against the rock that is Alan Cumming. Like, I was a sort of like, they were shipwrecked on the rock that is Alan Cumming. Like, whatever they did, it wasn't just that I was bad, that I just lured like a siren of bad acting. Actually, but those are the ones that you remember. I mean, it's like, I don't remember it because it was particularly, I'm not traumatized by that. I just think it's hilarious. Yeah. Like, I think if you're going to give someone a bad review, make it really good.
You say in your book, don't you, I can't remember the exact wording, but you say something about, like, if you're going to do it, like, do it properly, like, don't just kind of arse
it. if you're going to go down in flames.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, I think that was about when I was in that film, and it was nominated for all the Razzies, the bad Oscars.
Yes.
And I was nominated for the worst supporting actor, and it won worst sequel or something. But the boy and the girl, who were a couple in the film, were nominated for the worst on-screen chemistry. I thought that was hilarious, but also they didn't win. I mean, imagine. I mean, it's kind of tragic. I was nominated for the worst supporting actor, and I didn't win it.
Regent.
I know, furious.
I'm going to move on to our quick fire questions, Alan. All of the big life questions. These are the fundamentals on which I judge a person, so feel very judged. I'm going to give you two options, and if you could just fire back with your instinctive answer. Are you ready?
Okay, yes.
TV or theatre?
Theatre.
Classics or contemporary?
Classics.
Dull in Perthshire or Hell in Purgatory in Orkney?
Dull in Perthshire. My friend Kate lives in Dull. I think it's hilarious. Yes. I just love sending her things because it says Dull. Kate Isles, she lives in Dull. She is not dull, though.
She's not dull, but she lives in Dull.
Not at all. No.
Robert Burns or William Shakespeare?
Robert Burns.
Chippy sauce or no chippy sauce?
Chippy sauce. Yeah.
The Stalls or the Grand Circle?
Grand Circle. I always like seeing, it's just funny, today, actually, I just booked a ticket to Forbes' show that's in the RSC. I'm going to see when I'm over. And my assistant sent me a thing saying, where do you want to sit? And I had the the stalls and the circle and the grandstand. And I said, the circle, because I love seeing everything from above. Like, you know, especially big shows, you see the patterns. I love seeing dance from above. I hate sitting in the stalls because you just, it's like you're only seeing one dimension of the thing.
Yeah, you sort of need to like crank your neck up sometimes too.
Yeah, and actually you realise so many patterns and lovely things that happen from above or semi-above.
Stage left or stage right?
oh gosh, I think stage left, actually, I prefer. I did a video this week. I do this thing every Saturday called Saturday Night on Broadway on my Instagram. And I sort of sing this little song. I've been singing it for years every Saturday. And it's just become this crazy ritual now. But anyway, on this Saturday night, I was doing a concert in this theatre in Long Island. And I did it. I timed it. And I entered from stage right, actually, even though it wasn't my favourite. And I did it so that I timed it so that when the band started, the introduction, before I have to walk on, I timed being able to say all the stuff I normally say to the camera. And then the camera stayed on. And then I turned around, I walked on, and I waved at the audience, and they all cheered, and it was great. I loved it. I loved that. It was so scary, though. Doing something else as you hear the introduction music for you playing in the background.
Daredevil.
Balls of steel.
That is it, definitely. Period dance or stage fighting?
Oh, God. Oh, God. Sophie's choice. Not Sophie's choice, actually. I would give both of those children away. I guess period dance.
Highland coos or just coos?
Highland coos.
Fairies or elves?
Fairies. A-E.
Taggart or still game?
Oh God. I think Taggart, because there's nothing better than saying, there's been a murder. I remember there was a show, was it called, like one of those sketch shows that BBC Scotland, like Elaine Smith and C. Smith and everybody did. It was a kick up the 80s or one of those ones. And there was a sketch where there was a Taggart spoof and it said, Inspector Taggart, the headless body, corpse of a woman's been found in the Clyde. And Taggart goes, is she dead? I always love that. I don't know why it's always stuck with me.
Oh, I love it. The oldies are the best.
Yes.
And that concludes the quickfire questions. Well, thank you so much, Alan, for coming and chatting to me. You are just so much fun.
All right, darling. Well, see, maybe I'll see you at the Usher Hall. If you come, let me know, because I will be going out for a drink after.
I shall. You're on, Alan. Oh my goodness, what a hoot having Alan as one of the Cultural Coven witches. Thank you so much for joining us. And if you're enjoying the conversation, please do remember to subscribe so you never miss an episode. And stay in touch with us on Twitter at Cultural Coven or Instagram at Cultural Coven Pod 2. Next up is the brilliant actress of stage and screen and Equity president, Maureen Beattie. It's bye for now from me, Nicola Roy. Hope you have a good week and take care. The Cultural Coven is brought to you in association with the Stephen Dunn Theatre Fund and the Lyceum Theatre and is produced by Lee Kennedy with editing and engineering by Barry McCall and music by Cameron Barnes.